The LARB Radio Hour is a free weekly podcast of the Los Angeles Review of Books, a reader-supported nonprofit publication. To support our continued work on this show, in print and online, please consider donating or joining as a member today at lareviewofbooks.org/radiohour. Hello, and welcome to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported LA Review of Books. I'm your host, Kate Wolf, and I'm joined by my co-host, Eric Newman.
Hi, Kate.
Hi, Eric. And this week, we're listening to an interview that I did with the poet Victoria Chang about her new book, With My Back to the World.
Oh, okay. So, love the title.
Okay.
I have not actually read any of Victoria Chang's poetry, so can you just tell me a little bit about what the collection kind of looks at?
Yeah. Well, the title is actually comes from an Agnes Martin painting.
Oh.
Do you know Agnes Martin?
I do know Agnes Martin, but not well enough to have clocked
I think you'd have to be a real aficionado to have known that. I guess Victoria, you know, got a commission to write about some art at MoMA, and she chose Agnes Martin, as readers will hear in the interview. And from there, she just became really fascinated by her work. And the poems are, you know, what I really respect is someone who's written about art here and there. And sometimes with more abstract paintings, I struggle to know what to say, you know? And I really admire people who can just go deep into the formal language and like happenings of a painting, like an Agnes Martin painting. But for others of us, you know, it's more challenging. But Victoria really approached the paintings more as prompts. Like she'll write a bit about maybe an actual physical painting, but then she lets it just be associative. And she writes about Agnes Martin's philosophy somewhat and things she said. And, you know, she had, because Agnes Martin has such an interesting outlook on art and on life.
Yeah.
And what it takes to be an artist. And I think probably a lot of that resonated with Victoria. And yeah, just as someone also, you know, Agnes Martin is someone who had these crises in her life and who fled often, you know, these metropolitan areas to go live in the desert, who had suffered, you know, from some mental anguish at times. So that all comes into play. And yeah, the book is beautiful. I hadn't read much of Victoria's poetry before this, but I have friends who are just giant fans of Oba in particular, her book, where she kind of writes these obituaries to things and people. So,
ooh, that also sounds fascinating. So one, I can't wait to hear this conversation. And also now I'm definitely turning my eye to Victoria Chang's poetry.
There you go. I'm so glad. That's what the show is for.
Exactly.
But okay, well, let's listen to the interview so you can get more excited.
Sounds great. Let's do it.
I'm happy to be speaking with the poet Victoria Chang today. Her volumes of poetry include Circle, The Boss, Barbie Chang, The Trees Witness Everything, and Obit, which received the LA Times Book Prize, the Annisfield Wolf Book Award in Poetry, and the Penn Volcker Award. Other books of hers include the creative nonfiction work Dear Memory, as well as two titles for children and an anthology she edited on Asian American poetry. She serves as the Born Chair in Poetry at Georgia Tech and as Director of Poetry at Tech. She joins me to speak about her latest collection of poetry, With My Back to the World. The book is in deep conversation with the work of the painter Agnes Martin. Each poem takes the title of one of Martin's paintings and is also often accompanied by Chang's own visual interpretations of Martin's work. Regarding Martin's intricate grids and spare composition, inevitably allows Chang to reflect on form, emptiness, nature, and light, along with more personal reflections on depression, identity, solitude, violence, and destruction. Chang writes about the act of looking along with the feeling of being seen and the border between the two, especially within everyday encounters on the internet, where, as she writes, solitude grabs my phone and takes a selfie. Thank you so much for being here, Victoria.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So I wanted to start just with how you came to Agnes Martin as someone to kind of write to here and write towards and her work when you discovered
her paintings and what moved you about them to make you want to write to them in this book?
You know, I read her writings a long time ago, and at that time I had looked at her physical art pieces and thought they were really beautiful, but I didn't kind of feel that really visceral feeling that one can get when looking at artwork or reading something that moves them, but I thought they were gorgeous. And then the MoMA had commissioned me to write a poem on any piece of artwork in their entire museum. And I spent, you know, I'm very diligent. So I spent a lot of time looking through their catalog and writing notes and things like that, but I just didn't feel anything. And finally, I went backwards and thought, wow, I think I would like to write a poem on Agnes Martin. And then I searched in their database and found On a Clear Day, which is not just one piece, but it's multiple pieces. And then I think I looked online and I saw them all together and thought, wow, this is really beautiful. And then I decided to try writing a poem on that particular one that I just kind of liked in terms of the number of grids and things like that. And then once I did that, it felt like at some point I read that poem aloud. I felt like I kept on wanting to have a conversation with her and her pieces, because at that point in my life, I was feeling a lot of big feelings, and her work at that moment seemed to resonate with me in ways that it hadn't a while before that.
I want to ask you a lot of questions out of that, but maybe first we could hear that poem.
Sure. It's called On a Clear Day, 1973. And during the time of this writing, the Atlanta spa shootings had also happened, and so that makes an appearance in this poem. On a clear day, the horses disappeared. Just the apples they had been fed were left. The apples were strewn across the field and had become rectangles. When people found them, they still gathered and ate them. The people who hunched over their apples were far away, but the sounds of their chewing were over here. On a clear day, all the sounds fit into the boxes. On any clear day, all the thinking fits into boxes that can't be opened. What if our thinking was never meant to come out? What if it remains thinking within boxes? When out, it becomes weapons, takes on different shapes with sharp points. Today, there is no shortage of thinking, but all the thinking is divided into portions. Today, I'm hungry, but all the portions are gone. There are only 48. On clear days, there are only 48 birds, 48 people, and 48 houses, and 48 wars, and 48 apples. I keep counting grids, but no matter how I try, I still get 6 dead Asian women who don't fit into 48 boxes. All night, my thoughts are shaped like birds. In the morning, I lean in closer to the mirror, and someone has drawn lines across my face. I realize that failure consists of both the outline and the outlined, that lines are not meant to hold in our emptiness.
Beautiful. Also, that poem is in a grid formation. And throughout the book, I feel like there's this kind of almost mimicking of the form of Martin visually, but then to use, you know, this idea of boxes and the grid almost in the subject matter of the poem and the shaping of it is really interesting to me. And I wondered if you could talk about the process of kind of playing off her work visually in a written form and then also having this visual component of the book.
Yeah, I mean, I think when I was writing the poems, I wrote them like I have been writing poems, which is just in a notebook across the page. And so I'm not fitting the form in, like making the form or thinking about the form as much when I'm writing the language. But once I get to a point where I feel like the language is where I sort of feel comfortable with, then I start thinking about, oh, wouldn't it be neat if this poem kind of looked like this or looked like this? And wow, there's so much inspiration to choose from in terms of her artwork, because sometimes they're in these bands and stripes, and other times they're in these grids, and other times there are really cool ones like Little Sister, where the little metal pieces. And so there's a lot of variety. And so I thought, well, how can I Do any of those visual depictions or ways of form inspire my work? And occasionally it did, like some of them I just put in two couplets that mimicked like bands. Mountain 1960 looks like a mountain. And so I kind of played it by ear and looked to see what she did and if my poems might want to be in those shapes. And when they didn't, I just put them into squares or something like that. And then I did some drawings on top of that, that kind of were just, you know, for fun and another way to kind of think about Agnes Martin. So that's kind of how the form of the poems came about.
I feel like I've heard an interview with you where you say that you do visual art as well, or that is a part of your practice or something that you're interested in. I wonder what it's like to not have to come out as a visual artist, but at least allow visual art to be a part of a book or to kind of bleed from the poem into the piece.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all visual artists. We start very young drawing before we can write a letter. To me, that comes before learning language. And I always really loved drawing. As a young kid, I loved drawing. I just wasn't super like good at it, to use language that I can't really stand. But I also didn't have like a ton of passion for it in the sort of independent sense, because I'm very much interested in, to use academic language, interdisciplinary work. Like I just tend to be more horizontal. And so it wasn't that I wasn't as interested in drawing and things like that when I was younger, but now I'm realizing it's more of the relationship between drawing and that kind of mark making versus the mark making of language and how they might interact. And so the visual art that I do, and I'm working on some things now, isn't like this awe-inspiring visual art on its own. And it's not even that, you know, it's not even that new. It's very derivative. But I'm not really interested in that in terms of visual art, making something new or being kind of, you know, innovative. I'm, for visual art, interested in it as another form of language or another way to interact with the language that I have or the material that I'm working with or the subject matter that I'm dealing with. And when I'm writing and I have this sort of itch to work with my hands or do something else, it's because the subject matter or the material or the, you know, the thing I'm interacting with is asking for more. And I don't have any more. Like through language, I'm all done and dried out. I've squeezed everything out of that possible. So then I feel that's when I sort of pick up a pen or a marker or thread or whatever and, you know, paper, and just start kind of playing around with my hands to keep interacting with that material in some ways that language cannot get to.
Yeah, it's interesting to me looking at Martin's work or thinking about it, because I think of it as being kind of avant-garde in this way where there is almost some barrier to understanding it, or, you know, you think you need a certain amount of erudition to approach it. There's a visceral aspect of it, but when we think about how we understand it or what it could mean, it gets hard. And I think that trips people up the same way I feel like poetry often seems like this more elevated form that trips people up and not speaking so much to just the like basic things like what we experience as children, drawing, shapes. There's this feeling that we have to understand as opposed to experience it more viscerally. So that's something I wondered about with Martin, for you approaching her, and then also, you know, just the state of being a poet and existing a little bit in this more, what can seem to me like a partitioned off realm at times, that seems like people have ideas about poetry and don't always see it as so woven into everyday life.
Yeah. I mean, I love that it's not woven into everyone's everyday life, because then it would become this awful commercial entity like everything in this country seems to become. So
Right. It's
allowed me to exist on the fringes and the fringes of the fringes in the happiest, content way. And when it has become a little bit more sort of integrated into, you know, when the poet is pushed out into the world a little more than I'm comfortable with, is when I think to myself, oh, maybe it's better to be on the fringes of the fringes, and that's where I'm quite happy. But you just go with the flow, and whatever happens to you, happens to you. You can't really control your life, and so I try not to. But I definitely think, we were just talking about this yesterday in my workplace, because we're getting ready to gear up for National Poetry Month at Georgia Tech, and we're doing all these really cool activities, and we're talking about what poetry is. And I was thinking about Ed Hirsch in the book that he wrote, How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry, or something like that. And in there, he talks about how Paul Celan said, you know, poetry is a message in a bottle. And I kind of just love that, because that just sort of, to me, describes poetry in a really interesting way. Like, you get this message. It wasn't necessarily directed to you, but now it's all about you. You don't probably know who it's from. And even if you knew who it was from, they probably didn't put their address down or something like that. So you don't know. You'll never know so much who the person was, and not much more about what they feel. You're not sure where it came from. So it comes from this mysterious place across the ocean, and you're not really sure what you're supposed to do with it. But if you find a message in a bottle and you read that message, boy, it's going to conjure up a lot of different, very vast emotions. And I feel like that's what poetry is to me. And that's what Agnes Martin's pieces are. They're a tonal thing. They're like a feeling that they might evoke in a viewer at the right time. Not always. I mean, I think people have to be in that right moment to receive a piece of art. And for me, that moment varies, and I could not feel anything for a piece of visual art or a whole body of an artist's work or poetry. And then many, many years later, when I'm going through certain things that the piece can actually energize, then suddenly it means everything to me. And that's kind of what happened with me and Agnes Martin. I literally felt like I was seized by her work, and I found that to be electric, because it was exactly the work that I needed at that time. You know, when my mother had died, my father was so sick still, and he was on his last leg, unbeknownst to me, but it was feeling really a bit hard at that moment. And then, you know, I'm also not a young spring chicken anymore. So I was dealing with a lot of these physical and emotional and mental changes that can occur with someone my age. I think people often think I'm younger than I am, but I'm actually not that young. And so going through those bodily changes, it was so traumatic and difficult. And so I experienced a lot of difficulties, and her work just met me at the right time. I met the work. I feel very lucky in that way.
Yeah, I don't want to assume that the speaker of the poem is you, but depression comes up so much here. Just a very, very strong depression that kind of walks around. I mean, it almost takes on this characterization, and kind of following the line of Martin and then where the line ends, and the fear of like what's beyond that, fear of the unknown. I don't know, you know, whatever is comfortable for you to talk about, but it does sound like this period in which you're viewing the work is also a period where possibly you are experiencing a very strong depression.
Oh, yeah. And I think the reason why I wrote that word down is because it's got such a taboo in our culture. Yet everyone experiences some degree of depression in their lives. And sometimes some people experience it very deeply. Sometimes it's a thread in someone's life for their entire life. Other times it's just here and there. And once I wrote it once, it was really lovely. It just kept on coming up again. And then it became just like the word world or back or family. Like, it just wasn't a big deal anymore. But the first time I wrote it, I remember thinking, oh, if I write this now, then it's done. Then I have basically opened up a whole thing that I'm not sure that I want to open up, because there is the question of, is the speaker you? And then if it's not, then who has the right to write about it? And if it is, then how much of it is you? And then how much do you want to disclose? And I was like, I don't really mind about all of that. And I think my doing so was to reclaim myself and also to have agency over my own language and my own feelings versus society sort of pushing on us like, oh, you're not supposed to do this, you know, or not supposed to say that, you're not supposed to do that, or you're only supposed to talk about that in private, or you're not supposed to tell anybody this or that kind of thing. And I think the appearance of all of us is so important today, especially given the prevalence and overtaking of social media in some people's lives. I mean, I know plenty of people who are not on it at all. But for those of us who are on it, you have to be really careful because it can take up your whole existence and almost make you feel like that ends up being the real world, and it's not. And so I really monitor the time I spend on there. I post and run kind of thing. Because for me, I feel like if I spend too much time on there, it can lead to like bad things for me emotionally. But it definitely, even when I'm on there for a short period of time, I'm very aware of it all being about like the gaze and perception and how people perceive me in a very curated appearance. And I guess also writing those things down, I just wanted to be honest and say, well, you know, it appears that everything is always great for everybody. Well, unless people are doing that opposite thing, which is saying everything is terrible. So there are different kinds of people on social media, but I'm of the one where, oh, everything looks great, but it's not. We all know that nothing can be great within a day, within an hour. Like your emotions can go up and down. So many things can happen within a short period of time. And I just wanted to be real and wanted to be honest about that, that people often look at people on social media or just anything and think, oh, that's what I want, or that's how I want to be, or that's the person I want to become, or I want the things that this person has. And I just think it's all BS. And so part of just being honest with how difficult it was for the speaker, who is mostly me, not always, but mostly me at that time, that, yeah, I mean, why not be honest? And it's okay because it'll be fine. And maybe somebody will read it and they'll feel helped by something that you wrote because I was honest about it.
What does depression feel like for you, if you could? I know it's different for everybody in terms of how it manifests, but if there's like some words just that come to mind in terms of how you experience it.
Well, how I experienced it was I didn't even know I was, because I'm so good at operating at a high level of executive functioning and I'm so busy, and that I had and continue to have an enormous amount of responsibilities and feel great responsibilities for all sorts of people and all sorts of things and institutions and et cetera. And I feel that it's only a little bit after the fact that I suddenly realize that, oh my goodness, I have been feeling, or I have been depressed for so long that I didn't even know it. And actually, I think I may have realized that when I started looking at Agnes Martin's work, is because she dealt with all sorts of mental health things that I can totally relate to. And when I was reading about all of the work and her actions and how her sort of mental health manifested itself, she just gave away her paintbrushes. And I started thinking about, like, how does my mental health sort of issues manifest themselves? I was like, I just work, 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 and keep working and moving forward and don't even realize that, you know, it's like menopause is happening, gained 30 pounds. Like, I don't even look up anymore. I'm just, you know, for me, it's, I'm so accustomed and so good at being in the real world and being responsible that it's actually, I only realize it after the fact.
You're listening to the LARB Radio Hour. I'm speaking with Victoria Chang, author of With My Back to the World. Let's return to that interview.
Yeah, Martin is kind of thought of as this person who is extreme and extreme in her solitude and giving up art and then reclaiming it and making these really, in some sense, they seem heroic actions, but then also so much probably was related to her mental health and why she did certain things. But thinking of her solitude, and we all kind of have this image of her out in the desert, you know, painting by herself. And yes, that's more difficult when you're so tied to responsibility.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, it's like, that's sounds so glamorous, but it was a reaction It was fight or flight. It was a mental health response. And so, I mean, I think each person has to decide for themselves, like what they need to do to help themselves during those challenging times. And, you know, like I do things like work out or, you know, I do other things that I know that are very essential for my existence. I actually also do what I think she did too. I just turn inward a lot. And it may not appear that I do, but I really do. Like I really shut myself away from a lot of people in ways that they may not even realize. But I'm also very careful with, you know, who I surround myself with in terms of friends that I trust now more so than I did before. So, you know, I think we all just do something similar in the ways that she deals with it. I have friends who like I don't hear from for a long time. And I sometimes think, oh my goodness, like, where are they? And did I do something wrong? And then I stop myself and I think, actually, I know what's going on. I think they have really a difficult time in their doing what I do, which is I just become a hermit and I don't really talk to anybody more than I really need to for my job, if that makes sense.
I think about the book in terms of there's lots of questions about what would Agnes think about this, about that, kind of like, and it reminds me a little bit of some of your last books of addressing, you know, people that can't really answer back. This address, as opposed to kind of writing out to the line more, you know, pointedly towards a person and cultivating, you know, a curiosity and that kind of being the engine of a lot of the poems. Wondering. And I see that as very much in opposition to some of the ways you write about technology here, because it's not answerable, but it opens things up so much. And you spend time not knowing, as opposed to the possibility that basically any question that occurs to you today, you can just type into Google and you have some semblance of an answer. So I found that a very compelling thing here. I wonder if that's something you're consciously aware of.
Yeah, I think those are the only questions that I'm interested in. And those ineffable, unanswerable questions are those big questions that I'm always very interested in. When I think about the things that I read, I'm constantly looking for new contemporary books of philosophy to read. And the kinds of poets and artists that I'm always really interested in, I love all art. But the things that I actually genuinely really love are kind of like the things that are trying to grapple with those big questions. You know, I'm just looking at my shelf and I think I see Sebald and I see like Charles Wright. I mean, I see like some books of philosophy that I've been reading and trying to grapple with. And the books of prose that I usually like to read are kind of like those weird books of prose that are kind of undefinable in terms of genre. They're all over the place. But yeah, I'm reading like 25 books at least at once. But I think for me, that's kind of what I'm interested in, those big metaphysical questions. And I mean, I think if I could have done anything else, maybe I would have studied philosophy or whatever. But I think that's just my personality. My mind just tends to go very large, but in grappling with those large questions, it's like I tend to be very granular, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, I did think there were some propositions here that were incredibly philosophical. You know, I wrote it down, and in the poem that you read, you know, we talk about the lines are not meant to hold in our emptiness. There's this other part about closing your eyes in a field, and then you open your eyes in a field. I mean, it sounds like a cliche, but Cohen, like, ideas that you could really just like think about for a long time and that don't really
understand or agree with or disagree with or then re-agree with and then not understand again. Sure. I mean, I actually find writing those to be so fun because I don't even know if I agree with them or I don't know where that came from, but those big sort of random things that people say, I think are really fun. They're usually declarative. They seem to come from a place of authority. But then when you actually read about it, you're like, wait, when you actually read it, you're confused because you're not sure. But then maybe your initial reaction was like, wow, that's really true. and then it starts to unravel.
Completely. Well, it's hard to kind of parse out one-to-one how it makes sense or what it means, but something in the image holds, yeah, something compelling and that makes you reflect and reflect and reflect. And it's also interesting to think about emptiness when you're looking at painting, because it works a little bit differently. You know, you look at these Martin paintings and you're kind of like looking at these triangles that are empty, quote unquote, but maybe they're not empty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, then you start thinking, well, what is emptiness? What is silence? What is death? You know, those, what is beauty? Like all those big sort of questions. Why am I here? Like, I'm always thinking like, why am I here? And what am I supposed to be doing here? And every single person who's ever been born before me has thought the same question. And every single person will die. I mean, these are just like such big, strange things. Like, nobody's been able to figure that out, but people are figuring, you know, Google or AI out. And I just don't understand why no one can figure those things out. So,
well, it seems maybe because no one can. Yeah. They're not masterable, and people don't like the feeling of not being in control. So they search for these more petty things they can control.
Right.
It does seem like there's this line here about what, or the poem that where you mention this habit, I don't know if this is real or just kind of created in the moment, that you like to look at people as like the last thing someone wrote on Twitter right before they died.
Mm. Oh, I do like to do that.
Oh my God.
I mean, yeah, I do. I'm always thinking about the last things that people say, and we'll all have them. That's what I wrote in here somewhere, that we will all have our last words. And I was thinking about like, oh, you know, like yesterday I was talking to someone about how when my father was dying, I was just spent a lot of time looking at his feet because that's kind of where I was sitting. And his feet, I was like, oh, wow, those feet, they've walked a lot of places. And boy, did my dad love walking. And then I thought, oh, these feet won't walk anymore. When was the last time those feet stood up? It was before he fell. You know, I just like thinking about stuff like that. It's very morbid, but I'm a morbid person. I'm always thinking about death anyway. And I think I always have ever since I was little. So it's just something I just like thinking about. I find it to be very interesting.
Yeah, I do as well. And I think there's a profundity that we associate with last words. And then sometimes when I look on Twitter or whatever, any social media in relationship to death, I get a little bit upset because it seems like I do think of it as being a profound thing. And what it's met with is like emojis. You know, when you write and say like, oh, this person died, someone just does a sad face emoji. And that to me doesn't really match up. And it feels wrong. And I also think what you write about, you know, it's becoming harder to vanish. But the traces of us that are left in social media, I don't know if I think of those as being like great testaments exactly. So,
mm-hmm. Right. They're just detritus. Actually, they're all detritus when we're alive too. The whole thing is detritus.
Speaking of last words, did you happen to see the last painting that Agnes Martin made? And also in general, I'm curious like how you were viewing her paintings, if you were looking in them online or in person as much as possible.
When I first started writing, I think, you know, I had just done a ton of research. Like I see all the books up there. I ordered all the books and I got some really good plates. And so I looked online, but then I started kind of traveling a lot. And then I started running into the paintings. And so like at random museums, I would always, it's one of my favorite things to do. If I have to travel, I go to a city and then I just go find the museum. And then I would run into these pieces and I'd just be stunned by the fact that I just turned around and there was one. And then I started sort of seeking them out. So there are some places where they are. I haven't gone to all the places where they are, but I've gone to as many places as I can. So then I started writing poems based on my physical viewings too. And some of those appeared in here too. So it was a little bit of both. And then I'd go back and like some of them I've seen so many times, but it's different seeing them in person. It's really something else. The scale of them is really overwhelming in how large they are. I try to explain that to people. If I'm reading a poem, I don't have any visuals. I'm like, these are huge. And the importance of seeing them online is just, you don't get the scale. The scale is what gives it this largeness that evokes a lot of feeling for me.
The kind of physical viewing of them and your interactions with guards not letting you get close to the painting becomes a part of it. And I wondered, you know, there's this, the paintings are so abstract. And there's at times, like, there's a couple of poems where there's some tension, I think, between, you know, looking at this abstract work, 44 boxes. And there's one part where it's like 44 boxes, 44 Asian women who've been touched, I believe is, I'm not sure if that's the line. Or in the initial poem you read, you know, like looking at the grid and the boxes and then, you know, these women who have been murdered who don't fit into the boxes. And then, you know, you going to see, you know, kind of being an abstraction, but then possibly in this world coming back to identity, this difference between, you know, the freedom of the painting versus then the narrowing of identity or casual racism or, you know, hate acts, hate murder. And it does seem like something you're navigating around a bit here.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think there are a lot of threads in here. And it's really interesting when people start, you know, they started to read it and people have started to talk to me a little bit about it. And people's, the threads that people pick up on are always different. You know, like some people really pick up on the depression thread. Other people pick up on the identity thread. A lot of people also pick up on the feminist thread. And so I think that's all in here. These are really, for me, writing poems or making poems or things are just, you know, just like a process. It's just what I happen to run into or what happens to pop into my head at that particular moment that I'm sitting down. And if I had sat down like an hour later, then the poem would be different because it'd be different ideas or things that are passing through my head in terms of the images. But there are definitely, there were definitely and are, but there were definitely certain threads that were running through these that I feel like were a big part of my life at the time too. And I'm really interested in how identity plays into the ways in which we're perceived. And I was even thinking about that this morning. It's like, oh, would this person treat me this way or disrespect me in this way if I were a white man or if I were this person that I also work with who's in a different department? But I think to myself, I'm pretty sure this person wouldn't have dared to behave the way that they behaved toward me if I looked different. And so I feel like those are kinds of things that I experience on a daily basis. And something about Agnes Martin's work just made me brought it out. Like, whereas if I think maybe if I were looking at other paintings or writing a different kind of poem, I don't know if they would have come out in the way that they came out. Like there was something about the repetition and the constancy of things that the repeated aspect of her work, maybe I'm thinking aloud here, relates very well to, you know, microaggressions on a daily basis that I experience and I'm constantly experiencing and have experienced and will experience until the day I die, for better or for worse.
That's interesting. Yeah, I had thought of it more that, you know, abstraction kind of promises a universality and that then when you're marking people by identity, it's like, or when you're not seeing people kind of as a whole, and that's the tricky thing about race is both like, you can't erase it at this point, but it is also a construction. And so somehow it's like, it actually does not allow, if you have identity in mind, it doesn't always allow for this idea of like the universal, the fading away of any markers. You know, it's like, you know, like you are that, and that looking at something abstract might also bring about this thought of like, okay, well, here's where the line ends. Here's where it cannot dissolve.
Yeah. I think what's also interesting about abstract artwork is that, I mean, it also opens up the possibility for an individual to bring in their own experiences, which are very specific, which is this really weird kind of tension that can happen, you know, whereas if I'm looking at a portrait of a woman, I mean, I guess I could see aspects of myself in that, but if it's from the 16th century, then what parts of that can I personally relate to? So then what are other ways in which I'm engaging with the work? Whereas Agnes Martin's grids were just so capacious to me and so open and welcoming to bring in my own experiences. And so I felt like they literally intersected with my body. And I thought that was really cool, and which is why I love, you know, this kind of work, because I feel it's, to me, the opposite of, I think, what some people experience. I'm completely welcomed by it because it's not as much dictating my experience. It's inviting me. It's an invitation to enter the piece with my own experiences that are whole and welcomed.
That makes a lot of sense. I wonder, just in these last few years, seeing how people have been writing about Asian American identity much more, and, you know, because also of the knowledge that racism and like various hate acts have come more into the fore, and it's like asserting itself. It does seem like it's asserting itself more in kind of the popular imagination or whatever. What if you, as someone who's been writing about these things for a while, like what that has meant to you, or if that's meant anything to you?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like people are just aware that we exist now, aware that we also experience things that other people may experience as well, aware of their own microaggressions and racism and bias toward us is interesting to me, because, you know, obviously we've all experienced this and we all know what this feels like on a daily basis, but it's not like anyone else cared. And the fact that some people may be curious about our experiences in this country too is just a new thing for me. I mean, on all sorts of levels, the personal level, but also like the professional level, the writing world. Yeah, I mean, I feel like a lot has changed, and I think that's great. When I was first started writing poetry, I was like, I was pretty aware that, you know, there could only be one, like, nobody was really interested in anyone but one. And they were only interested in a certain kind of poet. You know, the poet had to only be writing about things that they felt like this poet should be writing about, kind of thing. And now I just look at the diversity of Asian American voices in the literary world and visual art. And I feel like there's a lot more that people can offer and a lot more to say, but it's certainly a lot different than it was when I first started writing poems, which was a long time ago. But I'm glad for these changes, and maybe that's why I'm always grateful, and I don't complain a lot, and I don't, I just am happy with the way things are in some ways, because I remember how things used to be. So I think I'm more easily satisfied with things, especially in the literary world. Like, I just don't feel the things that I think some people feel, because I'm always like, wow, you should see how it was before. Right, maybe that's right. That old thing. Like, oh, I used to walk 6 miles in the snow, kind of thing. But that doesn't at all mean to denigrate what other people feel, because what they feel is also real. But I feel a lot of gratitude on a daily basis.
So you have been writing poetry now for how long?
Long time. I mean, I started writing in elementary school, but not seriously until college, you know. But yeah, I mean, I'm 53 years old, so it's been a long time. I guess maybe I started writing seriously in college, so then like 18, 19 years old. But I wrote in high school, I wrote in elementary school, and yeah, I've always written like journals and stuff like that. So I think writing has always been a part of my life. But yeah, probably 25, 30 years, long time, but not regularly by any means.
You were in business school for a while, is that right?
Yeah, business school. I did other things, I had other jobs. So yeah, off and on. Like whenever I have time, or whenever I feel inspired, I'll write some poems, kind of thing.
Are you working on a new project now?
Oh yeah, I had a really rich writing period not that long ago. I finished a book of poems that I'm still kind of editing, but it's all done and it's all like mostly done. And then I finished a book of prose. I also resurrected some children's things. Like I have a children's verse novel that I resurrected and worked on for a little bit. That's also done. And then a bunch of children's picture books that I resurrected. And so, yeah, I was just really in a rich period before I started my new job in August. And since then, it's not been so rich, but it's okay.
Sounds like you got in a lot.
I did. Yeah.
Well, that's great. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, we'll definitely look forward to all those books.
Yeah, maybe. We'll see.
Thank you so much, Victoria, for speaking with me.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Thanks so much.
That was Victoria Chang. Her new book of poems is called With My Back to the World.
Thanks for listening to the LARB Radio Hour. Subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. If you like the show, please rate us on Apple Podcasts to help us get the word out. And we'd love to hear from you. The producers at the LARB Radio Hour are Medea Ocher, Kate Wolf, and Eric Newman. Our executive producer is Alan Minsky. Our sound engineer is Matea Baim. Editorial production by Jake Levins. Our intro music was written and performed by Imogen Teasley-Vlotten.